Welcome to the Resilient Training Lab podcast.
We're back with another episode of the Resilient Training Lab podcast. Today, our guest is Jared Maynard. So, Jared, thank you very much for taking the time to come on and talk to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
No doubt. So, I'm familiar with Jared through Instagram. And so you're a member or a part of the clinical athlete team, and you're also a physical therapist and strength coach. Is that fair to say?
Yes, sir. You pegged it.
Very cool. Can you give me a little bit of background on just like really quick, your intro to PT, what made you decide to go to PT school, and then how you became a part of the clinical athlete team?
Totally. Yeah. I'll give you the short version because it can be a bit of a long one. Intro to PT. I had wanted to be a doctor in high school, and then immediately after high school, as I got a better picture of what that actually meant in terms of schooling and time and money, I was just honest with myself in that my heart wasn't in medicine enough to make that seem like a really viable option anymore. So PT seemed like a really cool alternative, I guess. I was going to say middle ground, but alternative feels better. It was between PT, chiropractic, and being a high school teacher, actually. And my dad, God bless him, he really gave me a kick in the pants to get out and shadow at least one PT so that I could know more concretely whether or not I would fit well in that field before I decided to spend more time and money studying the field. And it clicked really well. And as I got further into PT school and certainly into practice, I saw how it ended up really giving me what I would have been looking for in the high school teaching position as well. And just on that point, like I had a couple of really great teachers who gave a damn about their students, who connected well with us, who were passionate about what they taught. And that role really resonated with me. And now as a PT, I get to do the same sort of thing. I also get to fill that role as a coach. And we'll talk about that for sure. But yeah, fast forward, I finished PT school 2015 up here in Canada, and then started working. And I had known of clinical athletes starting in like 2015, 2016, shortly after it became a thing. And then I applied to be a member of the clinical athlete directory, ended up working one-on-one with Quinn virtually because I had strained my hamstring in mid-2015. And so he helped me through the rehab process when I wasn't really getting very far on my own. And then fast forwarding the rest of it, basically I started up at a new clinic after moving. I was trying to build up my caseload. So I put together a seminar that was going to be free for the public on pain science, just to try to get people through the door, give them something tangible and useful, hopefully. But then also get them to talk to me and build things up that way. So I had one of my own personal consults with Quinn. And at the end of the consult, I said, "Hey, man, I'm doing this for my clinic. I don't know if clinical athlete could use it." And he said, "Sure, send it over." So I sent it to him and he said, "Oh, this is awesome. Do you want to record a webinar?" And I said, "Okay, sure. That sounds fun." So I did that. The audio and video quality was crappy. We had to do it a couple of times. And then Derek Sawyer, who's the co-founder of Clinical Athlete and very much behind the scenes, he asked if I wanted to come on board to help coordinate webinars generally, just as part of the team. And my role with Clinical Athlete has grown from that. And I guess that must have been 2018. So it's already been over 2 years, which is wild.
Closing in on three.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about your shadowing experience. If you look back at when you shadowed a PT to decide if it was a field that ultimately like captured your interest and you wanted to commit to, did you happen, like looking back, how was that experience shadowing?
That's actually a really good question. Through the lens of how I tend to think and practice these days, it's pretty poor in terms of quality of care, I would say now. At the time though, what really hit home with me was the fact that it wasn't super rushed. I guess the clinic that I shadowed at, I can't remember their exact like scheduling model, but it wasn't a huge mill where people were just coming in like you're on this machine and then you're on this machine and then we'll see you three times a week forever until you die or your insurance runs out. There was more of that one-on-one personal connection. I was able to help put people on and take them off of modalities. But as I did that, I got to talk to them and just find out who they were, what they did. And I remember talking to a police officer as I was working on his back or something. And the therapist that I was around seemed to genuinely care. And even though I might have my questions and potential critiques now, it was enough to make me think this is cool. And it showed me a path forward that would allow me to have the impact that I knew I wanted, even as a kid straight out of high school.
Mm-hmm. And so with this experience shadowing and ultimately moving forward as a PT, what did this transition into coaching look like? How did you end up working with so many strength athletes?
That started, I've been lifting weights myself probably since I was about 14 or 15, starting in my parents' basement. And then it was something that I did during the off season to get ready for football, try to get bigger and stronger. I never got that much bigger. I was about 165, but I worked hard. And then out of high school, I didn't have the courage to play high school ball or college ball, pardon me. So the weight room became my main outlet, and it was hugely formative that way. After university, I kept training. I wanted to compete in bodybuilding, and then eventually found my way to powerlifting. So it was after the transition to powerlifting, probably around end of 2016, beginning of 2017, is when I took on my first client, and I was working alongside my other friend at the time. We were doing it together. And our first client was another friend who trained at the same gym as us. And so it was very much the case where I was just like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, or at least it felt that way. But it ended up being a really fun process. I mean, certainly like anything, big learning curve, and it continues now. But I am able to experience more of what I really love about strength training through working with other people. And I'll go ahead and say, I think it's just as rewarding to me anyway, being able to see somebody go through their own journey and help out with that. Like, I play a pretty pivotal role in guiding that path and helping them get around or through obstacles. It's at least as rewarding as doing that myself. And I think that it definitely has, well, at least I like to believe it has impacts that go far beyond what I'm able to see in terms of my day-to-day interactions and even past the point of me working with that person.
Yeah. I always tell clients that, on meet day, I get more nervous as a coach than as an athlete.
Yeah, it's true, man.
As you started to kind of immerse yourself in the strength and conditioning field, are you still kind of treating at a clinic at this point?
I am. Yeah.
How did that kind of, well, I guess I have two questions and they're both big questions. Is how did kind of your experience, like diving into the strength and conditioning field and learning about that and learning about being a coach and having clients, impact the way you treat in the clinic? And how did your PT background affect your strength and conditioning coach knowledge journey?
Yeah, no, it's an awesome question, or two-parter there. So if you were to watch me treat, I mean, there's a huge bias towards exercise and towards active intervention, due in large part to my strength coach background and also just my overarching sort of philosophies and beliefs. And that's not to say that's to the total exclusion of other interventions necessarily. Kind of depends on the circumstances, and you know, that's a whole other conversation. But it's definitely, I find it gives me a lot of options. So I can think of one example, which might sound random, but I promise it makes sense in my head. There was a farmer I was working with, not at this current clinic, but the clinic beforehand. And he was having some back pain, and he would only get that pain in extension. I forget the specific tasks, but it was a situation where like it was a short enough list where only very specific things brought it on, but he also had farm tasks to do. So like kind of going beyond what most people would consider average daily demands. So I had to try to find some ways for him to work his back, his low back particularly, that was doable at home, that put enough stress on the affected area to get the adaptations that we wanted without pissing it off. And we went through a couple of options and like we just weren't finding something that either worked, felt like it was productive when it came to working the area that he was getting symptoms in, or wasn't feasible at home or whatever. So I landed on like a makeshift reverse hyper using his big wooden dinner table and like a TheraBand that I gave him. And I had a student with me at the time. And I think we had a conversation afterwards as far as her asking me why I chose the reverse hyper. I said, well, here are the issues. We tried these things and it wasn't working. There's this thing called the reverse hyper, which I'm familiar with. Wanted to see if it worked and it fit the bill for now. So I feel at least like having that strength coach background gives me those options. Now that said, I also have to check myself very regularly because I love strength training, obviously. That's why we're talking in the first place here. Not everybody else does, and not everybody is interested in lifting a barbell. Not everybody wants to think about doing strength training. They would be more receptive to a conversation if we put it in terms of, hey, here's some stuff that's going to help you pick up your kid better and without pain. So it's just trying to remind myself that not everyone cares about the same things that I do. And at the end of the day, it's not about me. It's about serving the people in front of me. And then as far as my or how being a PT influences me as a strength coach, having the PT background allows me to have greater expertise and I think comfort in navigating certain or navigating circumstances with injuries for sure and managing medical conditions. Now, again, we could get into sort of the weeds as far as the mechanics of it all. And, you know, when I work with people in one setting versus another, where the delineations are, I don't want any lawyers breathing down my neck after that conversation, but suffice it to say, it does give me more confidence. And I think a little bit more, I guess it comes back to options. Cause if I, even as a PT, if I'm working with somebody either in the PT setting or as a coach, and I come to realize or think that maybe this is a situation that I'm not the best suited to help this person in, I usually have more options in terms of people or resources to point them in the direction of. So that way the person doesn't feel like they're left high and dry, but we can kind of keep moving the needle in a meaningful direction.
Something I think is valuable for coaches is that we get to deal with the same people every week and consistently watch their progress and build a relationship with them. And I think from just talking with several physical therapists, that's something that, like, I guess if you're successful as a physical therapist, you don't see them again, right? Because they're back to the activities that they love. So it almost seems like you might get best of both worlds in that you can be helping somebody with PT, but still develop a relationship with them as a coach.
I think you pegged that there. And it's one of the challenges of working as a PT oftentimes is that physical therapy is often a grudge buy. It's the thing that people do when they have to, because they're hurt and like they feel like they need to. Not very many people, or at least not the majority, in my opinion, are super stoked that like, yeah, I got to go to PT now. You know? So that means a couple of things. One, you're right. You're exactly right, Ryan, in that if we do our job well, we've empowered the person enough, we've given them the tools that they need to handle their situation, hopefully they're out of that really rough time and they're good. They know that we're in their corner if they need us in the future, but hopefully they don't need us, right? It also means that when people start feeling better, there's a really common thing where people just like, they fall off because they're good and they don't have the same need they had before, which again is good. But the tricky bit in a lot of circumstances, I think, is having enough time to work with that person to really make sure that they're good enough, not just to get through this situation, but that they have the tools and skills that set them up for success as much as possible for as long as possible. And I also believe, just sort of overarching philosophy here, that good healthcare really involves and should involve anyway, a good amount, like just healthy lifestyle and physical activity recommendations. And it looks more like fitness outside of like the typical way that most people are going to think about rehab or medicine or that sort of thing. So Anyway, that's a long rant to say that, yeah, I agree.
Dude, I mean, you led me right to where I'd like to go next and what I'm excited to talk about. It ended up working well. Beauty. So when you mentioned not everybody wants to be lifting weights, right? That's our bias. It's an activity that we strongly associate with our identity, and it's something that we're going to do for the rest of our lives, but not everybody wants that. And, you know, we can, again, argue whether or not that's allowable.
Yes.
But if we could start with like a hypothetical patient who, you know, expects 3 sets of 10, fix my pain, give me this one exercise to do. I'm going to do my dining room table reverse hypers and I'll do that for a week and then I'm good and I'll never see you again. What are some ways that, and again, like if we started with just physical therapy, what are some ways that you help patients create habits that allow them to be successful when they are no longer with you, or like should 3x10 of TheraBand exercises not do the trick?
You mean 3x10 with a yellow TheraBand won't fix everything forever? What are you talking about? That's a really good question. I really think it starts with the first encounter with the assessment, and particularly the subjective part of it. And not that it's limited to it, but I think we really set the stage there. So if we come into that encounter as clinicians, recognizing that, again, it's not about us, and that we have an opportunity to really try and help this person if we're able to help them. That, I think, frames everything in a much more productive way. And then a couple of things I think need to happen. One is we need to try to get to know that person and their story, where they are currently, where they've been, what issues they're having, and ultimately where they want to go. We also, to the best of our ability, need to get them to like us. Because if they like us, they're more likely to trust us. And if they trust us, they're more likely to actually do what we ask them or tell them to do. And it's just one of those things, working with people, it's not like you just need to earn that trust. And I don't think this is a call. I don't think it should ever be a call to be disingenuous or to just say things that the patient wants to hear, but to genuinely strive for that connection. You're not going to hit that with everybody. No one gets along with everybody, but you can try, and I think you can get better at it. So by starting off with that and really digging deep into what their situation is, what they've tried in the past, what they think is going on in terms of the problems that they're facing, and what they think they need to do to get better, I make it a point to ask those questions at the end. That helps me to know a little bit more clearly where they are and what they're expecting to get / hear from me, which either helps me to know that I'm on the same page as them, maybe for this topic and this topic, and maybe that I got to circle back around to this narrative or this idea that may need a little bit of updating. But then it gets to be a tactical decision. Is that something that I have to address here and now? Or can I start to just chip away at it little by little as I get a feel for them, they get a feel for me, and that sort of thing. And then the last two questions that I ask in my subjective after, what do you think's going on? What do you think we need to do to get you better? Is I've stolen this question directly from my coach and mentor, Frank Benedetto, which is, let's say I'm talking to you, Ryan, as the client. Ryan, let's say we hop in our time machine and we go 6 months in the future or a year in the future. Let's say Ryan's life is perfect. All your dreams are coming true. Paint me a picture, a vivid picture of what that looks like. And I find that when I ask that question, I get one of two answers usually. One of them is like, oh, there's usually a twinkle and like kind of a smile that most people have, because I don't think people are used to being asked that question. And they ask, like, you mean just with regards to my back or my shoulder? And I just say, however you want to answer it. Because underlying idea, it's a person that we're dealing with. It's not just the painful back or the painful shoulder. It's them and all of their beliefs and their hopes and social and physical environment, all that sort of stuff. So that helps me to know where they want to go. And it really underscores their goals and their aspirations. And then that helps me to know what connections I probably need to try and make with the interventions or the things that we're doing to make it click for them. Because if they tell me in a year that, let's say it's an older person, they want to be able to pick up their grandkid at, I don't know, their grandkid's sixth birthday or whatever, I can find out how much the kid weighs, give or take. And then as we start doing some hip hinging or some squatting or some whatever, I'll just casually and repeatedly say, yeah, this is going to make sure that you're able to pick up little Timmy at his sixth birthday party, you know, because you're doing this and this is what you have to do for picking him up. And that just helps people to recognize how what they're doing now, the often unfun and like unsexy kind of stuff, how that gets them where they want to go. And then the last question I ask in the subjective is what their expectations are for that day. Like what needs to happen at the end of that session or that call for them to feel like it was a good, productive first session, which further drives home what they're expecting from me. And then I get to tell them for sure, this is going to happen. Or if we're a little off in terms of them wanting one thing and me being able to provide another, I'll say, okay, totally hear that. How about this? What I really want to focus on today is getting in, doing some tests and just getting a good understanding of where we are. And then I'll tell you what I think is going on in as much detail as I can give you. And most importantly, we'll land on a game plan together that makes sense and that has you leaving here feeling confident that you're going to get where you want to go. That sound okay? And then yes or no. So anyway, that was a really long preamble. I'm going to bring it around to finish answering your question here. As far as how we can set people up for health and wellness and success over the long term, even beyond seeing a PT, through the rest of that process, it's revisiting these topics that maybe need further conversation. Like, it's like, hey, you're doing really awesome with these exercises. Do you feel like this is sustainable? Like after we're done seeing each other and your back doesn't hurt anymore, do you think this is something that you might want to continue doing? Yes or no? I mean, if they say no, awesome. That's one step closer to finding what they actually are going to want to do. And then maybe having a conversation about how we know that while it's not foolproof, we usually reduce the chances of things like this back pain happening again. If we can keep you strong and even get you stronger, like, is that something that you're open to talking about more and maybe finding some ways to keep you doing this, but also ways that you enjoy doing after we're done seeing each other? And then just sort of pulling on that thread, seeing where it leads you. But yeah, I guess if I had to summarize that whole thing, that 5-minute long monologue, it would come down to genuine connection and an understanding of their story. And then finding strategies and solutions that are in line with their goals and having conversations along the way to connect the dots, but also planting the seeds early about how in a strictly PT or rehab sense, like this should end. Like hopefully if I've done my job well, you don't need me for this issue anyway. And I want to make sure that you're good come the time that we reach there. So hopefully I didn't put all of your listeners to sleep with my soft, soothing voice and long-winded answer.
They're here to listen to you, man, not us.
I don't know if that'll help, but I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, it all comes back to helping them find their why and being able to connect what they're doing with what they want to be doing. It's like that Christmas commercial that was floating around on Facebook of that old man and his kettlebell. Mm-hmm. So he could lift his kid up to put the star on the tree. Like, of course,
that's someone's going to get that.
Yeah.
Tears. Not gonna lie. I almost shed a tear. It was very close.
So like when you can connect exercise with things in your life that have meaning, you're more likely to internalize kind of what you're doing in the gym or wherever you are working out nowadays. So if you can really start to, and I think people come to the gym or come to working out for, you know, a variety of reasons, but they tend to be more superficial. They're, you know, this hurts, get me out. I don't want to hurt anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I need to lose some weight. I want to look better. Like, they're usually pretty superficial reasons, but when you can start to dig a little deeper, there's usually a more meaningful reason why they're there, that really drove them to make that big leap. Because coming to a strength coach or a physical therapist is a big leap, like especially if you've never exercised before. So being able to ask those questions and start to figure out, help people figure out why they're really there. Because sometimes they don't even realize. And it's like you start talking to them and then you realize that like they can't keep up with their kids anymore, or they, you know, had trouble getting off the floor and their kid called them fat or something. And like, you're like, oh, now this comes up an hour into our conversation. Like, and that is the biggest part of the assessment, I would say, is both on both positions.
Couldn't agree more, man. Just to chime in and add on that. Everybody's got a reason why. Like people are motivated by different things to do things. But you know, going to see somebody, paying money, spending time, trusting somebody else in some capacity. Like these are all things that aren't super comfortable, or they require an expenditure of resources and energy. And like to get someone to find the value in that, or the supposed value in that, means that the value has to outweigh the cost in some way. And oftentimes it can be this sort of subconscious recognition of it. And it takes some digging to get there. And this comes back to the rapport, to the trust. People aren't going to tell you that deep, dark thing that's really motivating them to change unless they trust you. If they don't know you and they don't like you, they're not sure shit ain't going to tell you what their kid called them fat and that made them feel how they felt when they were bullied as a kid. Right. It takes digging and time to get there. So being able to ask good questions helps to start to peel back those layers as you establish the initial trust and keep building on that trust. And this is again where I owe a lot of credit to Frank Benedetto and the Honey Badger Project, which I'm a part of. And through being part of that, we've learned a lot about not only how to engage in a sales process. And sales is like this word that has always felt dirty to me in the PT or the strength coaching world, because I've seen it done so poorly and I wanted no part of it. But I think, and I'm stealing this again from Frank, I think that for people like us who are in the spaces that we occupy and who have services to offer that we do, who are genuinely focused on helping people and getting them where they want to go. And if we can be really confident that we have the ability to do that, if we've got clients that are happy and have gotten where they want to go, and we're consistently doing decently with that, I think that allows us to have some certainty and some conviction as we have these conversations, still recognizing that we're not the right fit for everybody personally. There's probably going to be somebody else who's a better fit, but we can ask these questions, these often uncomfortable questions of, all right, so you want to get stronger. Why is that important to you? You know, we can ask these questions because what we're trying to do is get to the heart of the matter and understand that we're doing all this for them. Because if we can get to the heart of it, understand what they want, and if we can be that much more sure that we're a good fit for them and that we can help them get where they want to go, especially knowing what we know about the research around health and wellness and disease and quality of life in the presence or absence of strength training or healthy lifestyles or what have you, I think that's more than enough reason for us to feel at least more comfortable starting those conversations, you know, having them tactfully, becoming better communicators so we can have them more smoothly, but recognize that it's, sure, we're getting paid for our services as we should as skilled professionals, but at the end of the day, it should be beginning and ending with helping these people get where they need to go.
A conversation I'm interested in, because you talked about communication right there, and you would have an interesting perspective on this. because you're both a physical therapist and a strength coach, is like, we have this bullet point here in the outline, controlling the controllable. But I think for us as strength coaches, like, people have bad days, right? They come in, strength just isn't what it was the last session, and they're really bummed. And it's just like, hey, you showed up, great job. Like, you're better for it. You'll have a great session in the future soon. Mm-hmm. But with something like pain that is not easily explained or understood, and there's no clear path to like not having pain or having an improvement in symptoms or activities of daily living. So it's like, mm-hmm. how do you approach a conversation or coach your patients when there are things that are so far out of their control that it like they might just want to give up?
Yeah, it's tough. And my answer to that question really varies. And I will qualify that, because I hate when the answer is, well, it depends, and it's left there. Like, depends on what, damn it. So first off, let me say that I think you're exactly right. And controlling the controllables is hugely important, because there will always be things that we can't control. Some pretty damn big things too. And this is my inner stoic philosophy bias showing, so excuse me. But yeah, so I think that it again begins with building some trust with that person, and maybe at the outset letting them know, like, hey, okay, so we're in a situation where your back is hurting. It's been hurting for about 5 years, off and on. These are the things that tend to piss it off, and this is what brought you in the door this time. Here's what you want to do in terms of goals. I'm telling you as a PT or as a coach or what have you, that I firmly believe we can get you there. And here's how I see us doing that. However, it's important for us to know right now that there's a very good chance that we're going to have some bad days. And the reason why I say that to you, hypothetical patient or client, is so that we can expect it. Because if we expect that there are going to be some rough days and then they happen, kind of shrug it off, be like, all right, cool. Well, here it is. We knew it was going to happen at some point. Versus if I told you it's going to be sunshine and rainbows and unicorns are going to poop, you know, starlight from now until you reach your goal, and then it doesn't happen that way. Not only is that person probably feeling derailed and demotivated, and how that can spiral into a bunch of thoughts like, I'm really broken, I'm never going to get better, which makes the work harder, but their trust in you also gets shook, right? So anyway, I think planting that seed early on is important, and I think it's equally important to follow that up, that sort of dose of reality, with a contingency plan. So I often like to have conversations around my guidelines that I like to use for how much pain is okay and how much is too much. And I'll run through those shortly if you want. I also like to tell them, if we find that we're in a situation where you're in too much pain or it's a flare up, here's plan A, plan B, plan C. And I want you to tell me, because I'm going to help you through it no matter what. And knowing that the client, or on the client's part, knowing that they have somebody to journey with them and to guide the process so they don't feel like they got to do it all themselves, I think that goes a long way. And I couldn't pull up articles or researchers right now to back it up, but I do believe we have enough evidence in the realm of, you know, pain science and the realm of psychology to show that just feeling supported and feeling like we've got some backup helps us with confidence, and that on its own tends to help reduce the likelihood of ending up in a really rough spot with pain and that sort of thing. Did that start to answer the question, or did I go off in the weeds again?
You're good, man. You actually, again, like, led me right to a question that I'm really curious about for me as a coach, right? So something that I'm aware of that I do, and I think it's like a line that I flirt with, it's like, how do you prepare somebody and set the expectation, like, things might not be great, but not nocebo them into mm-hmm. like whatever shitty thing you might not want to happen.
It's a fine line to walk, man. And yeah, it's been something that I've struggled with for a long time. I definitely don't do it perfectly these days, but I think I'm better than I used to be. I think the framework that seems to work the best, or that I think seems to work the best, is, I guess there are three parts to it. One is, it should ideal, these conversations ideally happen in person, just because you get the additional nuance of nonverbal or verbal and nonverbal communication. You get to deliver it in a certain way. The client gets to hear your tone of voice. They get to listen to your cadence of speaking. They get to see your body language, that sort of thing. And that matters a lot. Like, that's not really something that should be news to a lot of people. If it is, I mean, just think about the last time you got into a text fight with your significant other, and that should prove the point pretty well. But yeah, so conversations happen in person, which for a lot of us, it does. I mean, the Rona notwithstanding and all these Zoom calls, but hey, it's a pretty good proxy. The second one is shooting straight and not sugarcoating things necessarily, like, or the better way to phrase that is to not beat around the bush. Because even though we can be dealing with situations, whether we're talking about working as a coach, working as a clinician, there are situations that just suck, where, you know, there are some real consequences that have to be discussed, or possibilities that have to be discussed. I think that we owe it to the person we're working with to not necessarily play with kid gloves and not assume that they're not strong enough to handle that reality. So just speak plainly, be compassionate and empathetic, and use some tact. This is, again, where you got to read the situation, read the person, and use an approach that is probably going to work well with them. But, you know, speak plainly at the end of the day. And the third portion is follow it up with something. And this is one of the controllables. So the controllable might be, here's how we're going to know whether the pain that you're experiencing or the symptoms that you're getting, whether it's okay, whether it's too much. Here's how I want us to quantify that or figure that out. Here's what we're going to do if we find ourselves, or if you find yourself with too much pain. Like, here's a contingency. And also, like, I'm going to be there. Tell me. We're going to have a conversation. And I've dealt with this. This is, again, trust and them seeing you as an authority and an expert. Because if they know that you've worked with people in the same situation and you've done well with them, they're more likely to sort of be a little bit more at ease and think, all right, well, if I find myself in a jam, you know, Paul's going to be able to help me out of that. So that's sort of the three-parter framework that I see working well. And some days that's all we have, because there are a lot of things outside of our control. But I think as we get better at communicating and as we build that relationship with the person, we become more effective at making that count and making that enough.
Yeah, I think that third part there is the key, right? That holds all that together and keeps maybe some of that nocebo from creeping in. And it's like, if we can frame it as, we're going to get you to your goal, you're going to progress, you know, over time, but that progression is never linear. There's going to be peaks and valleys.
Yes.
But we are going to, here's the things we can control, right? And this is what we're going to do to control those so that we can have the best, you know, journey possible. But there's still things we can't control, and you have to be okay with those things, and I'm here for you to help you deal with those uncontrollables when they do happen, because they're going to happen. And I think letting people know that, you know, they have the power to get from point A to point B, that it's not going to be easy though, but they have the power and they can control enough to make the difference in that journey is the deciding factor, right? Like, if you tell them, like, yeah, it's going to be a bumpy ass road, and then not give them the tools to handle that, then of course they're going to feel like shit when those bumps come.
Buckle your ass up.
Yeah.
Well, I totally agree, man. And it, again, from what I keep reading and learning in the realm of psychology and how that applies to coaching and to working as a clinician, people fear the unknown. Like that's a common feature of the human experience. So by being able to let people know, like, hey, here is what we can expect. Suddenly we've shed a little bit of light on the probabilities. We also acknowledge that we kind of suck a lot at accurately predicting how the process goes, but here are the common trends. And then here's how we're going to deal with them. We suddenly allow them to, in one way or another, maybe future pace themselves and see, just briefly imagine like, all right, my back hurts, but I'm going to start doing these things and it's going to feel better. Or I'm going to let Ryan know and he's going to make these adjustments and we're going to be okay. Suddenly it's less scary because they've been there in some sense. And they also know that you're in their corner and you get to guide the whole thing. And this is what you do. Like, you're the expert. This is why they trusted you in the first place and why they continue to trust you. And if you set these expectations and they end up happening, like they end up having a bad day and you end up having a good conversation, taking stock of where they are and making a reasonable decision to modify things or progress things or regress things, and they feel better, think of what that does for their trust in you. Like, oh shit, he said it was going to happen and it happened and he did exactly what he said he was going to do. Oh, this is awesome. You know? And that only serves to help, I think.
And something that you brought up earlier, and like, I don't think we explicitly stated it, but it's like focusing on the process rather than the outcome. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the guy who was in that commercial. And it's like, it's not like he went to go try and pick his kid up every single day and then one day he was able to. It's like he focused on the process for an extended amount of time. But I think we've all had those clients or patients who's like, oh yeah, well, like, I just tried squatting 315 because I wanted to see if it hurt. And they're like 2 weeks into PT, or, you know, we have clients like, oh yeah, I got pinned with this last week, but I wanted to see if I could do it this week. So it's like trying to keep the reins pulled on some people can be challenging.
I look at him like, you're one of those.
Okay. How did you fail in RPE 7?
RPE 7 with a misgroove, bro. Jeez. I'm not bitter.
Yeah. What percentage of time do you spend working with like patients versus clients?
Yeah. So in the clinic, I'm in the clinic 3 days a week, and then I'm doing my work for both Unbreakable Strength, my company, and Clinical Athlete 3 more days of the week. So I'd have to, I'd actually have to do the breakdown in terms of how many encounters that ends up being, but it's getting closer to about 50-50 these days.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you had envisioned when you were in PT school? Did you know? No. No?
Not at all. Yeah, in PT school, I wanted to be like the best manual therapist that I could and work in a suite outpatient clinic. And like, that was the dream. I knew I wanted to do orthopedics, sports med, that sort of thing. And I'm very happy in sports med and ortho. And I think that it's in line for sure with what I'm doing now with coaching and all that. But it was very much an evolving sort of process as I learned how much more I loved strength training. And, you know, just to go with the short version too of my own personal backstory, I went through a really tough period of time, like one of the lowest periods of my life when I was trying to compete in bodybuilding, or that's what I wanted to do. It was not a good fit at all for me. I have the utmost respect for anyone and everyone who competes in physique sports. I think they're awesome. I will almost certainly never be one of the people who does it. Just it's not a good match with my very type A, very neurotic, and at the time, very anxiety prone self or tendencies. So it put me in a rough spot. Shifted over to powerlifting, and it was a much better fit in terms of the focus on more objective outcomes. I also didn't need to be focused on getting down to a certain level of body fat, which again, for me at the time, wasn't a good fit. And strength training really has been the catalyst for years now in terms of making me more of who I am and who I want to be in terms of developing character, developing the traits like perseverance, being able to deal with failure and come back and face scary stuff and like do it anyway. Just to name a few, it's impacted how I parent. We've got three young girls, three kids under 3 years old at home because we started off with twins. So that's fun. But the oldest two, like they're around me in the basement when I train. And my hope is that I get to help them know that strength training is a very normal thing, especially for girls, and make them feel strong and capable and all that sort of stuff. And then the other thing, especially in the last year or so, is just seeing how much more impact I can have working with people, not just as a PT, because I think that is very impactful and I love doing that, but also as a coach, and exploring the different avenues to do that, because knowing what strength training has done for me and how much it helped to save me, especially considering where I was at that point in time, and at least one other really, really low point since, strength training has been the anchor. It's been what pulls me back time and again. And knowing what it's done for me, I've made it my mission to bring that to as many people as I can so that they can get strong, not just for the gym or not just for the platform, but have that spill over into every other aspect of life. So yeah, it's been a very evolved, iterative kind of process, which has been cool.
Yeah, that, you know, hit close to home and had a similar life experience. But I think there's just something about lifting that can create some consistency in your life despite what may seem like everything else spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
And during those low points in your life, having that consistency and something that makes you reflect on what you're capable of on a regular basis is a extremely powerful tool. And is a reason, a big reason why creating these habits for a lifetime is so important, because during those times, the last thing you're going to want to do is go to the gym and lift weights.
Yeah.
But it's probably the most powerful thing you can do. And if you can get to the point where it's just part of your life and part of who you are, and it's something that you do without much thought, it's going to become extremely valuable in times where there's chaos everywhere else.
Totally. I mean, I think this ties back into the concept of controlling the controllables. If that gets to be a constant and it is something that you can control it, in large part, you know, there might be some things, some circumstances that crop up that stop you from training the way you normally train or the way you want to train. But I tend to see and tend to think that there's usually some way for us to do something more often than not. And being able to have that routine, that grounding effect, that anchor really allows people, generally speaking, to sort of fill up their cup. And if our resources are better taken care of, if we feel like if we follow through on our self-care, especially if training is part of that self-care, it allows us to show up better for the people who need us. And that's a hard, hard lesson. It has been a hard lesson for me to learn. I think it's hard for a lot of people who would identify as givers. And I think that coaches and rehab providers are absolutely usually givers, or they have that tendency. So being able to have something that's for you or for us that we do and that we protect allows us to better serve the people who rely on us. And it's this weird thing that seems like a dichotomy at first, but it really doesn't have to be.
Yeah, it's a really hard lesson to learn.
So. Yeah. I still struggle with it, man.
It's just part of the like growth mindset process, right? Of just always trying to be more efficient or find little ways that you can make improvements or adjustments. And like never actually have it figured out.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, and I think kind of tying back all of that that we just talked about was the idea of being able to deal with failures and how in the weight room, especially as you lift longer and longer, you're going to probably start having more and more air quote bad days. I wouldn't say any day in the gym's a bad day, but you know, in the moment they feel bad. And how learning to kind of deal with these failures in the gym carries over to outside of the gym, because you know, you are going to fail a lot in life. Mm-hmm. And the more you're kind of faced with that situation, the better you get at dealing with it. So even furthermore from, you know, it becoming part of your identity and an anchor during rough times, it almost prepares you to deal with rough times because you're dealing with them regularly, although probably not on as big of a scale.
I think you pegged that one. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I was just kind of tangenting.
I got excited because well, let me lead into it this way. So not just because I'm a Rogue Fitness fanboy, but my wedding band is the Knurled wedding that they started marketing a few years ago. The first time I saw that, this is probably a couple of years before I got married anyway, I was like, that's the band. That's what I'm going to get. Maybe because I'm partially a Rogue fanboy, if I'm honest, but also because I've spent a lot of time thinking about how much time I spend under a bar or with a bar in my hands, and how the lessons learned doing that, and how the qualities that you need to show up and do that regularly and spend excessive amounts of time in the gym, like I have, like all three of us probably have, just what those mean and what impact they have and will continue to have on the rest of my life. And dealing with failure is one of the biggest things that it's helped me to get better with. Because for me, I'm very much a perfectionist, very much someone who does not like to fail. I hate losing, very sensitive to criticism at base level. I've gotten better at it over the years. But if I work hard on something and you say like, that was okay, but like, you kind of messed this up. Shut up. Don't tell me that. So with the bar, it doesn't give a shit. It's 400 pounds, 400 pounds. You could either be strong enough to lift that day or you're not, but it does not care. However, if my goals involve challenging myself and eventually getting past that point, I'm left to confront the fact that today's not my day to lift 400, or I got hurt and I got to back off, but I'm going to come back for this. It gives the opportunity to make those choices about whether I'm going to either accept the failure and leave it there, or accept that failure temporarily and do what I need to do to come back and win later. And that second one is what I've consistently chosen for, I forget how long I've been training for with the powerlifting focus. 2014 would have been it. So last 6.5 years, give or take. And choosing to come back and work and eventually win wherever I can. That's absolutely bled over into everything else, from parenting to working in the clinic to my yard work and my subpar handyman skills, like all sorts of stuff.
I don't think I've ever met a strength and conditioning coach who's been like, yeah, I'm real handy, you know?
You're making me feel good about myself now. Yes.
Yeah. Both Ryan and I, like, new gym equipment comes in and we're like, he's like, who's going to put this together?
Where are the tools?
So I went with the welded together R3 rack. The fewer bolts I had to deal with, the better.
There you go. So that reminds me of that Henry Rollins quote and it'll be a good wrap up of the conversation we had. So I'll throw it up there. I just Googled it.
Nice.
The iron never lies to you. You can walk outside and listen to all kinds of talk, get told that you're a god or a total bastard. The iron will always kick you the real deal. Friends may come and go, but 200 pounds is always 200 pounds.
Preach.
That sums it up.
100%, man. 100%. Lessons for life taught by the iron.
Been reading that quote since, like, what, I don't know, for me, like 2008 on bodybuilding.com or like 2006, something like that.
Catch me in the bodybuilding.com forums, buddy. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like everybody's little, like, signature.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, thanks a bunch. If people are interested in checking out your coaching company, your content, I know you have a lot of Instagram posts on these specific topics. Where can they find you?
Yeah, Instagram is where I'm the most active. So jared.unbreakablestrength or at jared.unbreakablestrength. Hit me up there. Shoot me a DM. I'm real active there. I'm happy to talk to anybody, especially if they've got any questions or they just want to shoot the shit and talk about fun fitness memes. I'm always down for the memes. You can find me on Facebook too. I'm all right in terms of activity there, but just search Jared Maynard. If they want to shoot an email, it's unbreakablestrengthonline@gmail.com. And then for anybody not currently following Clinical Athlete or the Level Up Initiative, I'd highly recommend doing that. It's at Clinical Athlete, at the Level Up Initiative. And the two companies are coming together to do this really cool thing, making the official Kalu community. There's a lot of free resources on there, so go check those out. And it caters definitely to both the strength coach and clinician worlds. So hopefully I'll catch people in one of those avenues.
Yeah, they're very doing cool, great stuff at the, I guess we'll call them Cal U now.
Now the debate is it Cal U or Cal U? And that's going to be like the pineapple on pizza.
From the leaders themselves, I hear Cal U is too like that kids cartoon that everyone hates.
I absolutely agree. And that was my original stance. But it's grown on me, and that's all I know now. So I'm a little shaken.
Uh-oh. There's going to be some drama there.
There may or may not be infighting. Yeah. I'll leave that for now.
I know Steph and Zach both had strong opinions when they were on.
I feel like Zach said Kalu when he was on the podcast.
Uh-oh.
Somebody go back and check.
Go back and check now.
Somebody fact check this. Yeah, we just the pot. We just need some good drama.
All right. Fine. Well, thanks for coming on, and maybe we'll talk again soon.
I would love to. Yeah, thank you guys. Thank you for the invite. Thank you for the time. If you want to do this again, let me know. I'd be happy.